This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There's no shortage of people who attack hip-hop music as crude and shallow and maybe even dangerous. And there's no shortage of people who defend it. Usually, that's the people who make it, produce it, and buy it. What is unusual is when that defense comes from the halls of academe. Enter Michael Eric Dyson. For several years now, in books and journals, university halls, and on talk radio shows, he's argued that this music form is one of the most authentic expressions of the black experience ever. Hardly perfect, not above criticism, but at its best, at as important and as worthy of serious study as any art form. Professor Dyson has a new book out on the topic. We invite you to call in and talk with him about his views on hip-hop. And yours. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. A bit later in the show, we'll review the winners and the runners-up in the voting for the new Seven Wonders of the World with Don George of Lonely Planet. But first, Michael Eric Dyson, university professor at Georgetown University. His new book is Know What I Mean? Reflections on Hip-Hop. He's here with us in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program, and welcome to Washington.
It's great to be here, and thank you so very kindly.
The book, interestingly, what you start out with is a defense of hip-hop against a lot of the criticism, some of which is justified, but you say, there's a lot more to it than just the things that are wrong with it.
Absolutely, Neil. I think that those who are Johnny-come-latelys or Snoop-come-latelys to the hip-hop game certainly have overlooked the evolution of this art form, how complex and nuanced at its best it's been. Of course, there's much to be critical of, to dismiss some of the commercial expressions of hip-hop that tend to be droning on, mimetic, repetitive, the same stuff you hear one place, you hear it another place. But I think at its best, hip-hop has also offered the world a glimpse into the heart of people whose misery has usually been shielded from broader mainstream view, and people who want to tell some truths that other people, especially even black elites, don't want to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yet it's almost defensive. There's an aspect of part of the criticism is hip-hop is, so concerned with victimology.
Right.
And in your very first chapter, you're addressing the criticisms. You get to the praise of it, the genius of it, if you will, in your second chapter.
Absolutely right. No, that's a great point, because you have to begin on the ground. And on the ground, people, and I mentioned in the book, John McWhorter, Martin Kilson, Stanley Crouch, Wynton Marsalis, no mean, sloppy intellectuals those. But I think it's important to talk about how hip-hop is broader and deeper and more complex and more profound than even they're willing to give it credit for. And so one begins exactly where we are in the culture. And of course, given the Don Imus affair and the aftermath of that, it's not too hard to be a bit defensive in the most technical sense of that word for an art form. You can't say, well, all of it is bad because some of it's bad. That's something that's been done to black people, by the way, from the very beginning. And some of the same arguments I want to tell Stanley Crouch and especially Wynton Marsalis made that you make against hip-hop, people made against jazz to begin with, that very art form you defend.
Sure. I remember Theodore Sturgeon, the great science fiction writer, was once asked, why do you write in such a genre where so much of it is garbage? I don't think they were using the word garbage. And he replied, 94% of everything is garbage.
There it is. I mean, you know what? Hip-hop is no different than science fiction or than the latest book by the sociologists who's out here doing some ethnography or the fiction of people who are attempting to reach a commercial audience, whether it's music or culture or art or film. A bunch of it is horrible, some of it is good, and a small percentage is genius and great.
Genius and great, no
yes.
less than genius.
Oh, my God. When you think of a guy like Jay-Z, you know, now my mama all my parents couldn't reach me and my mama couldn't beat me hard enough to match the pain of my pops not seeing me. So with that disdain in my membrane, I got on my pimp game. Or Nas, it's only right that I was born to use mics, and the stuff that I write, it's even tougher than dice. I'm taking rapping to a new plateau through rap, so my rhyming is a vitamin held without a capsule. Now, you don't capture all of the genius there, but there is an enormous wordplay, a facility with language, the power to articulate truths that are deep and profound and sometimes people, others who suffer, find that they are inarticulate in the face of that suffering, that rappers come along and at their best tell the truth about it.
Interesting. You also talk about the way that rappers were on the cover of white magazines before they were on the cover of black magazines.
That's exactly right. And they were on white TV before they were on black TV. They were on MTV, MTV said, wait a minute, you mean we got a rap show? It's the lowest overhead, because mm-hmm. what do you got to do? Show a bunch of videos of rappers, and they're doing their thing, and it was their huge success. So they were on MTV before getting onto BET, on Rolling Stone and other magazines before making it into the black culture. What's interesting is that people closer to the natural marketplace of ideas within black America spurned it. It's horrible. Turn it down. It's bad. Now, mind you, this is before gangster rap. Mind you, this is before N.W.A. Mind you, this is before all of the cursing and the B words and the N words were flowing out. This is when Chuck D is saying Elvis is a hero to most, but he never meant to me straight up racist. The sucker was simple and plain mother. Him and John Wayne. I'm my own beeper. So the reality is that even when rap was at its height, politically speaking, during its so-called golden age from about 87 till 93, mm-hmm. People were still arguing over its estimable artistic value. Now, in the aftermath of some of the decline of not only the sales of hip-hop, but the aesthetic appreciation and achievement of hip-hop, people are beating up on it and acting as if they were hailing the golden age of hip-hop, when indeed, when it was here, they didn't say much about it.
Mm-hmm. You write about how the older generation, you talk about the older generation of black Americans, mm-hmm. had a revulsion to the iconography of hip-hop, to the low-slung plants, to the bling, to the diamond teeth, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it is. It's both generational and, I think, class-based. I think generational because older people, as older people do, you know, when they were young, they forget that they wore their hair long and that Elvis the Pelvis couldn't be shown on, the Ed Sullivan Show, or they forget Jackie Wilson or Sam Cooke with his sexual threat. All of a sudden, that looks tame. Now they see the low-slung pants and they're going to get all upset. I'm waiting for the generation of low-slung pants wearers to get old and they'll beat up on their kids, and I'll go, you were wearing those low-slung pants and those gold teeth. Don't be romantic here.
Mm-hmm. Let's get some listeners in on this conversation. Our guest is Michael Eric Dyson. His most recent book, Know What I Mean, Reflections on Hip-Hop. And if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. We'll begin with John. And John is calling us from Venetia, is that right, in California?
It's in Venetia, California.
Venetia, go ahead, please.
And I've listened to rap for years, and I should say I used to. It seems to me now it's a 21st century minstrel singing is what it is, where people are selling the most crude stereotypes to a mostly white audience. And things that have mostly died out, like the N-word, have been brought back into vogue, mostly by what people are putting out today.
Interesting. Well, you know what? There's enough justification for what you just said to write a couple books. There's no doubt that the minstrelsy that some people have seen has been quite evident in some artists who have no sense of consciousness of history and who replicate some of the bad stuff that used to circulate before. But that's not the entire story. And some of the stereotypes, true. But I think great art at its best is not to reaffirm our best values. Great art should challenge us. Great art shouldn't mollycoddle us. It shouldn't make us feel good. It should get in our face sometimes and tell us, you know what you're doing is not right, or what this artistic representation is something that you should be engaged with. So I think that at the same time that there's minstrelsy and stereotype mongering, there's also playing with stereotypes. I mean, what's interesting about hip-hop is that they can play with some of these stereotypes of the pimp, or the B, or the H, or the person who's been the urban urchin put on the margins of society. There's much more play than people are willing to give it credit for. So while the stereotypes and the minstrelsy is there, there's a lot of great art that is being overlooked and ignored. The stuff that gets on the radio, commercially driven artistic expressions, certainly fails to compare to the best art that is often left aside.
Mm. Thanks very much. John, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was going to say, don't you think the average audience, though, of these young, teenage, suburban white kids are not sophisticated enough to notice the difference between a tongue-in-cheek commentary and an actual presentation of what black culture is?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think that the burden shouldn't be on the hip-hop artists. It should be on the white parents who rear them and the white teachers who teach them, or the black teachers who teach them. Snoop Dogg, after all, is not W.B. Du Bois. The reality is that we don't expect Pee Wee Herman to educate people about the complex nuances of Jewish comedy. But the reality is that, yes, people sometimes, young white kids, if that's our major concern, I notice you didn't think that the black kids might find it problematic, but if the young white kids are looking at it, taking a tour of the ghetto easily without paying the price of their lives or suffering through fear, you're right. They may not be able to make that distinction, but some of them will be able to make that distinction. And if the only thing they're listening to or looking at or consuming in black culture is hip hop, that would be a problem, because black life is so much deeper and broader and huger than the canvas upon which these people paint.
Hmm. John, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
The other thing you write, you were talking about the golden age of hip-hop, and that amidst all of its concern over definition and authenticity, it seems to have fragmented into different genres, almost, of hip-hop.
Oh, absolutely right. It's a great point. You know, in not only genres, you got geographies. You got the Dirty Dirty. You know, aha, hush that fuss. Everybody move to the back of the bus. Do you want to bump or slump with us? We the type of people make the party get crunk. What? What did you say? What was that? What did you... Is that English? Right? You got that down in the Dirty South in Atlanta, you know. Then you've got stuff over in Atlanta from T.I. Then you've got stuff from Jay-Z and Nas in New York. You've got stuff in West Coast, California from Snoop and the Game. Then you got different genres... You know, conscious rap, so-called politicized rap, black Afrocentric rap. You've got gangster rap. You've got hardcore rap. So all of these different genres and geographies suggest that rap is a art form teeming with not infinite possibility, but huge possibility. And the rhetorical wordplay at its best that characterizes hip hop is still of vital importance to those of us who love the art form, despite its problems.
The wordplay, I'm sure we'll get calls about the problems as well, but the wordplay, you quote one line from Jay-Z, "I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman.
So let me handle my business." So absolutely right. Here's a guy saying, look, I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. So I'm a business to be invested in. I'm a entrepreneurial activity by myself. So allow me the opportunity to expand as a great corporation will. Yeah, the huge importance of a Jay-Z or of a Nas or of a P. Diddy as business people who have leveraged the authority, the popularity, and the incredible, you know, financial windfall that can accrue to those who are at the top of their game in hip-hop is worth remarking upon, but also the fact that a guy like Jay-Z can be a great businessman and still have the ability to spit lyrics in a way that is utterly remarkable. He and Nas, as the great geniuses, I think, of the contemporary rap form, certainly represent that art form at its highest.
We're talking with Michael Eric Dyson about his new book, Know What I Mean? Reflections on Hip-Hop. We'll get more of his thoughts on in just a minute, and we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. You can also send us email talk@npr.org or join us on the blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Michael Eric Dyson about hip-hop music and why he argues it's such an important form of expression. In the intro to Professor Dyson's new book, Jay-Z writes, "It's one thing for young people to see rappers on TRL or to see their records fly up the chart. It's another thing for a young boy from the hood to go into the library at his school and check out a book on why his culture matters." Quite literally, Dyson has written that book. The book Jay-Z refers to is called Know What I Mean? Reflections on Hip-Hop. And Michael Eric Dyson is with us here in Studio 3A. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org or send us comments on our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's get back to the phones. Greg is calling from Jacksonville, Florida.
Hello, Neil. Thank you very much.
So go ahead, Greg.
Greetings, Dr. Dyson.
Greetings, sir.
I'm a law enforcement officer, and of course, being in law, my biggest concern, I deal with a lot of violence. And I know, and you answered a great deal of my question just by listening to you, the great diversity in the genres of rap music. But it seems like the more violent rap music is what's being played to a large majority of people in the inner city, especially. And whenever we have violence that occurs and we have suspects and we deal with people, we notice that that rap culture, that part of the genre, plays a large part in their lives, because the difference is when I was growing up, I'm 43, you know, we loved rap, but we didn't live a lot of the things that the children live now.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you, what do you think is the positiveness that these children should be receiving from rap music?
Yes, sir.
And if there's, I am grappling trying to find the positive in it. because I'm out here with these kids every day. I try to read as much as I can. I've read several of your books, and I'm trying to get some type of understanding of the culture that they're living, this culture of violence that has actually just permeated all aspects of our society.
Yes, sir. Well, that's a great point. The next to last chapter, the penultimate chapter of my book, deals with violence. Cover your eyes as I tell a story, quoting from Common. So you're absolutely right to be concerned with and occupied by the question of violence in hip-hop and the as yet undetermined relationship between gangster rap lyrics and the violence we see. I suspect if you did a correlation between gangster rap at its height and the declining levels of crime, you'd find an interesting paradox. That is, when gangster rap was at its height, the crime rate actually went down. So we can't draw a one-to-one relationship between crime rates in the actually empirically verifiable world and the music they hear. Now, having said that, let me not deny that glorification and glamorization may not be empirically measured. It's the kind of psychological addiction to violence that I would confess that I'm a fan of, The Godfather. Look how they massacring my boy, or the fact, of course, that I just went to see Live Hard and Die Young or whatever that movie is by Bruce Willis. So the violence permeates the culture, as you say. It's not just in hip hop, but they are attracted to hip hop because hip hop tells their story, and it does celebrate killing, carnage, murder and crime of others. But it also tells another story. Listen to Tupac. Somebody wake me, I'm dreaming. I started as a seed, the semen swimming upstream, planted in the womb while screaming. On the top was my pops, my mama hollering stop. From a single drop, this is what they got. Not to disrespect my peoples, but my papa was a loser. Only plan he had for mama was the blanker and abuser. And even as a seed, I could see his plan for me. Stranded on welfare, another broken family. Now, I would tell you, even out of the violence of a Tupac Shakur, you can hear the incredible vulnerability that he expresses. And perhaps the music can urge some of these young people to not only deal with the violence, but to talk about it and to be honest about it, to engage each other with it, and to tell stories and truths that others would rather dismiss. It's never neat, it's never perfect, but it's a possibility that art becomes a handmaiden for some truths that these young people then cannot engage in the real form of violence out in the street if at least they have an outlet where they can tell their stories elsewhere. It's not perfect, it's not perfectly balanced, and I commend you for the work that you do, and I would commend you to constantly listen to the music of these young people and then challenge them to do better in their lives, because there are always artists like Common, like Mos Def, like Talib Kweli, like Lauren Hill, like Bahamadia, who tell a different side of the story. And if you could join them to that different side of the story, I think you'd be doing a great thing.
Thank you. Can I ask one more question, Neil?
Go ahead, Greg.
There was an article on NPR earlier today in which they were talking about teachers in North Korea. And there was a black teacher who they were trying to get teachers to come in to teach English. I mean, in South Korea, rather.
I was going to say, yeah.
South Korea. And there was a black teacher who had difficulty because of the racism. And the comments that were made, and I'm a black man myself, the comments that were made were that they did not trust they trusted the whites to teach their children the correct English. And with English, with language goes culture. They did not trust the blacks to do that. Mm-hmm. You have a great command of the English language. Do you think that this rap music allows our children to say that I don't have to command to gain a command of
sure.
the king's English
right.
in order to survive in society, because it's pretty evident that it hurts us.
Yeah,
I'll
that's
take
a
comment off the air, and I appreciate you.
Greg, thanks for the call.
It's a highly cerebral and intelligent question. I think, look, it's the chicken or the egg. Is it the fact that it's a defense mechanism of young people who are told that they're illiterate, that their words don't count, that their mouths are full of the most inarticulate consonants that one might be able to conjure? So as a result of that, they then resort to what we might call an ebonicized expression. Now, for most people, ebonics means, well, there's some black people who can't talk. No. Ebonics has rules. Zero copula. A copula is a form of the verb to be. Not I am going, but I be going. There's a tense that's conjured. When I was at Princeton University studying my PhD in religion in a German class, the instructor said there is no tense in English to receive the translation of this German phrase except in black English. It bees like that. I said to myself, I knew black folk had it right all along. Let me tell you something, son. Black people been doing most stuff with the language. Yeah, I got a command of it. Thank God. I've been trying to study that for a minute. But I came from people who lived on literal rhetorical chitlins, the pork bellies of the language. And they took it and made futures markets to be sold on the stock market and the commodity. So I don't buy into this demonization of young black kids, even though I tell my kids, you got to master all forms of language. The King's English to the Queen's taste. And you got to speak on the street. If you're on the street speaking the King's English and somebody says, watch out for that alley apple. Excuse me? Alley apple? What's that? Is that a fruit that grows in an alley? No. In my neighborhood, that was a brick. So survival depends upon understanding context cues of language in specific communities. So everybody's language is important. It depends on how it's spoken, how it's recognized, and where it's acknowledged. We should do both. Master the king's tongue to the queen's taste, but also your indigenous vernaculars are important as well.
Email from Tim in Scottsdale, Arizona. As a musician of 20-plus years, I can honestly say hip-hop appears to be the lowest form of musical art, which he puts in quotation marks. A drum machine sampler and someone blathering out rhymes, you're comparing this to traditional blues and jazz. Come now. And you address this, again, and a lot of people saying, you know, particularly musicians saying, right, these people don't play instruments.
Well, yeah, but you know what? They don't play instruments because what? They're in the schools where the budgets are slashed. I played clarinet. I was first chair in the 9th grade. I had the opportunity, even in the ghetto of Detroit, to be able to play da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's cool. Or if we played some jazz. A lot of people don't even acknowledge jazz or gospel at a certain level, right? In the Harlem Renaissance, that was the great European music, not the indigenous black music. So my point is, if you take the instruments away, how ingenious is it to do what Claude Levi-Strauss said, the great anthropologist? Bricolage. Take what's at hand. Look at the genius. They took some broke-down turntables, set them next to each other, began to cue the records up, and now a billion-dollar industry has grown out of young kids experimenting with that. I call that genius. That's genius, bro.
Let's get Paul on the line. Paul's with us from Tallahassee in Florida.
Hey, Mr. Dyson, I want to tell you that I'm an absolutely huge fan of what you do, and I think we need more thinkers like you out there.
Bless you, sir. I appreciate that.
I wanted to ask you about the sort of perspective you take, how it balances sort of a pop culture perspective, a hip-hop culture perspective, and an academic perspective. Mm-hmm. Certainly you are an academic, and I wanted to get a good idea of how you've balanced that over time, tempered the two forces.
Yes, sir. That's a great question because, you know, let's be honest. I exist in the academy, and in the academy you don't get much kudos for writing books that people beyond your profession can comprehend, understand, worry about, or engage. The academy is extraordinarily snobbish. It is condescending. It wants to write books initially that 12 people can comprehend. Now, I ain't mad at that because part of those 12 people could be a Supreme Court justice and the future president of the United States, although given present company, that might have been more chiliastic than we thought. Anyway, the point is that it is an ideal after which we strive to be able to be competent and intelligent and academically sophisticated and rigorous. On the other hand, you got to get your stuff out there where people can understand why it's important and why what you do is important, why the stuff you write about is important. So it's an extraordinary balance. Thank God I got tenure very early in my career. I got a PhD 1 year. I was a full professor with tenure the next year. So I in one sense, sidestep some of that stuff. I don't sidestep the criticism because when you write for a broader audience, sometimes people think, well, it must not be rigorous because it's accessible. Wow. So I was taught that the best artist is one who doesn't let the seam show. So because you're able to finesse it, it doesn't mean that you didn't put the work into it. Just because you don't see me sweating don't mean I ain't working. So I think the reality is that you've got to understand in your mind, what is your purpose? My purpose is to communicate to as broad an audience as possible the rigorous intellectual reflections upon specific issues and then bring them in a way that will be both delightful and provocative. And when you do that, I think when you make up in your own mind what your career and your vocational aspiration is, you're able to make a contribution.
And let me follow up on that. In terms of the form of your book, you do this as a very conscious emulation of rap and a combination of hip-hop and academe.
That's a great point. Yeah, this particular book is seen as they're tracks, they're not chapters. It's a written CD. It's a lyrical CD, if you will. I deliberately want, instead of chapter acknowledgments, I put in chapter credits, guest artists as opposed for the person who's interviewing me,
as opposed to footnotes.
So footnotes and so on. Because in this book, I got footnotes in plenty of other books, so don't y'all worry. So the point is that this is an attempt to and the form of it. This is an attempt to reach this hip hop audience. The form of the essays in the book. These are interviews of me by other scholars and people in hip-hop, and it's me spitting the truth as I see it, telling the truth as I see it. So it's organized in such a fashion to be oratorically similar to the very métier and to the very heart of hip-hop culture.
Here's an email from Anne in Cincinnati. I rarely hear anybody credit the influence of Jamaican dub, spoken improvised rhyming patter by DJs added to reggae songs, on the development of hip-hop. It came shortly before hip-hop and was very popular among West Indian immigrants to Brooklyn, Bronx, and Queens, where hip-hop began. It usually was the B-side, and then couldn't record another song, so they did a dub version on the B-side of the single.
Yeah, man, a sac passé. No doubt. I mentioned this, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I mentioned it in my book. I talk about the Black Atlantic, the triangulation of Black identity from British culture, African-American culture, or from European, some ports in European culture, and how Blackness can never be settled exclusively in one particular port, whether it's British culture, Caribbean culture, and African-American culture. That's a great triangle. And I speak about that in the book because you're absolutely right. Black people and Latinos and Jamaican-influenced people. Think about DJ Kool Herc coming over here in sparking hip-hop in 1973 with those big booming sound systems that he transferred from the West Indian culture to the Bronx. So I talk about this in my book. It's a great point, and we should remember the roots of hip-hop in Jamaican culture.
Michael Eric Dyson's new book is Know What I Mean, Reflections on Hip-Hop. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Stacy on the line. Stacy's with us from Denver.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask about, I think that lyrically and listening to hip-hop, it has a lot to offer, as you discussed already. I think one of the hardest things to swallow is watching these videos where women just appear to be, objectified to a new level. I am the first to admit that in the 80s, hair bands started a lot of that stuff with girls in bikinis and running around. But if you look at the hip-hop videos on the TV today, I just think it really does a disservice to any culture, let alone Black culture.
Yeah.
And I was just interested in your thoughts on that direction that the art form has taken.
Yes, ma'am. Amen. amen. I mean, it is. It's pretty reprehensible. It's odious, nefarious, foul, messed up, funky, and horrible. And furthermore, it does, and you put your finger on the pulse, I think, in a sense, because it's the visual representation, the visual economy of hip-hop that has been extremely seductive into perhaps inviting people to believe that the only place for women, especially Black women, in the political economy of sex in American and global culture is as a hoochie mama, a whole skeezer, a slut, chicken head, somebody services the masculine and especially the heterosexual male crotch. So at that level, you're absolutely right. It would be hard to argue against that, even though we know more broadly that the economies of sexism that operate in our culture, sometimes the most effective ones are the most seductive ones, therefore the most subtle ones. For instance, the point is that when you see Snoop Dogg coming and you see Girls Gone Wild, okay, he didn't invent that. Some, guy who did invent that got in trouble recently. And then Snoop Dogg and his videos and then the pornography, all those industries have, in some senses, colluded or at least, had some kind of agreement at a certain level. But what's interesting is that the most perfectly powerful forms of sexism are the ones we can't operate. We can see Snoop Dogg coming and say, you're wrong, you're terrible, it's horrible, look what you're doing. It's the more subtle ones that are problematic. So that when I suggested to my friends, Reverend Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, instead of in the aftermath of IMUS protesting record companies, how about smashing some of the sermons of those ministers who stand up on church on Sunday morning in Black America? 75% to 80% of those churches are attended by Black women. The minister is not calling them the B word or the H or the skeezer or slut, but he is reinforcing a gospel that subordinates them to the interests of men, and therefore he's much more seductive. He's got a bigger pulpit, he's got a bigger platform, and he's got God on his side. Snoop Dogg never claimed to be Jesus in rap form, but many of the ministers claim to be God's representative on earth, and the message from the minister is, God wants you to be a second-class citizen because men should run stuff. I'm not trying to say that offsets the horrible nature of the visual seduction of hip-hop culture. I'm saying it's easier to go after that than it is to go after these more subtle reinforcements of sexism and patriarchy in our culture.
Thank you. That's very interesting. I appreciate it.
All right, Stacy. Thanks very much for the call. We just have a minute or so left with you, and we've seen other musical forms of the 20th century as they become so consumed, as they're burned up by the demands of the marketplace so much, right. Fragmented and ultimately changed, transformed. Where do you see hip-hop going? Is it going to kind of re-coalesce as a vibrant form, or is it going to fragment as so many others have?
Yeah, that's a great point, and it's a great question. I think that yes, all of that. It's certainly, look, you saw the USA Today article that said it's declining art, you know, sales of hip-hop suggests that people are tired of the same old humdrum, you know, variety, garden variety, gangster, and the bling and the women. Let's get something new. So I think that it impales itself on its commercial success, ironically enough. The sharp edges of its success are the very source of its demise. But there's a vibrant underground in hip-hop. You go to YouTube and you see all the stuff, the viral media that is enlivening hip-hop again to the local outposts of the culture that permitted it to do so well. So I think that even as commercially hip-hop has hit a huge wall, I think the vibrant underground scene suggests that there's much lyrical genius that needs to be explored and tapped into, and I think that hip-hop will have a bright future because of that.
Michael Eric Dyson, welcome to Washington.
Thank you, my friend.
Michael Eric Dyson, now university professor at Georgetown University, and his new book, Know What I Mean, Reflections on Hip-Hop. He joined us here today in Studio 3A. Up next, 100 million votes were cast online, and now we have 7 new wonders of the world. What do you think deserves the title Wonder of the World? Was anything left off the list? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.